Hello, friends and travelers. Thanks for listening. You are riding along on the Hostel Road Trip Podcast. Our mission is to spread awareness of the true hostel experience in the Americas and share stories from the fascinating hosts who create those unique facilities. I'm your host, Jimmy Black, joined alongside co-founder of International Travelers House, Bobby Dyer, and Eric Faria, co-founder of World Packers. Each session, we sit down with hostel operators or travel influencers to hear about their road to success, discuss trending hostel topics, and close with tips for travelers who are seeking to have the ultimate experience when visiting each destination. You can't afford to miss this trip. Now fasten your seatbelts and let's hit the road. Welcome back to Hostel Road Trip. We are closing out a wild week. We've braved the coast. We've gone through wildfires. We've traversed mountains. And now here we are in Cerro Gordo, 1865 mining town, 3 hours east of LA, in a badass old saloon, and I'm literally sitting in a chair where a man was shot to death. You just can't get more exciting. I think there's five people here. There could be more. So we will find out when we do the editing. I'm very excited for that later tonight. But it's been a wild week. We're super excited to, grateful to be here with Brent Underwood.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
And Aaron Saltzman. Say hello.
Oh, hi.
Don't be so shy.
The sarcasm, Aaron.
Don't let the ghost speak for you.
Yeah, sorry.
Bobby Dyer from ITH.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us, guys.
And Eric Faria, still awake from World Packers.
Thank you, guys. Glad to be here, too.
All right. So we're going to talk a little bit about your personal journeys before we dive into this badass facility, town you've bought, and all the cool structures you've got on it, and the eventual guest experience you're going to try to create. But, Brent, you've got a very interesting hosteling background.
Sure.
That comes after an investment banking background. So if I may let you share your experience with the volatile hostel market of New York City.
Yes.
As you were one of the pioneers and pirates, if you will,
yes,
of that industry, who was kicked out but survived.
I'm still here.
So tell us about New York a little bit.
Yeah, I went to school for finance. Mm-hmm. I went to Columbia for real estate finance. And I graduated in 2010. And, you know, the track after that is you go into a lot of debt, you get a job in an investment bank, you work really hard, you start making a lot of money, and then you get a nice apartment, and you kind of, you have the golden handcuff, so to speak, you know, you
yes.
have a nice car, but you need to make the money to support your lifestyle. And so I got a job at a bank called KBW, it's a real estate investment bank in New York, and I was making great money, you know, like, it paid very well. I was 22,
mm-hmm.
and a month in, I kind of saw the handwriting on the wall,
mm-hmm.
and I knew where this was going. I quit. I took 6 months and traveled the world. I went through Central and South America, staying in hostels exclusively the whole time, really falling in love with the atmosphere of hostels. I think that's why everybody probably listening and you guys kind of fell in love with the same atmosphere. You know,
mm-hmm.
you go there, you learn so much, you get to know about people, you kind of have this interesting, unique lens on the world. And then I came back to New York, and the idea was I was going to get that out of my system, come back to New York, and start a quote-unquote real job. And then I came back, I applied for some jobs, and it didn't feel right. I really missed the road. I missed that atmosphere that I had in hostels. And so I was like, you know what? We should try to start a hostel here. But New York, if you're not aware, it's pretty expensive.
Uh-huh.
even 6 years ago. So we found a commercial space, but the time and energy and money to get a permit to operate as a hostel was going to be very expensive. And
mm-hmm.
so we, full transparency, I think the statute of limitations is up. we didn't get any permits. We bought a lot of bunk beds off of walmart.com.
Yeah.
We filled a brownstone in Brooklyn. Aaron actually has been to the brownstone.
Oh, yeah.
It had a rooftop. It was actually pretty badass. But we filled all of the rooms with bunk beds. And at the time, I didn't want to go on hostel work because I thought it was going to attract too much attention.
Yeah.
So we're Airbnb only. You know,
mm-hmm.
this is 2011, so it's like Airbnb was still kind of early-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you could thread through the legality of it all.
Yeah.
And actually, in our original mind, the idea was like, I know a lot of people come to New York. If I could get like my friends and their friends to stay here, I could like make rent. You know, that was my only goal. This is like cover my rent in New York.
Yeah.
And then we put on Airbnb, and then like that day it was like 20 mil. 2 mils, 3 mils, 4, 5, 6, 7. You know, like, because like we priced it so much lower than anybody else in New York because we could. We didn't have to. We didn't pay for the permit. So like, I mean, like, of course we could price it cheaper.
It was also in the ghetto.
Very, very important point. We were literally in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, which is where all the rappers grew up. We were across the street from the Brevoort Projects, where the rapper Fabulous grew up. There was a shooting there. I literally had to pay for protection the 3 years that we were there from a guy named House.
I love it! Shakedown!
No, yeah. House is a local gangster / drug dealer that, like, he...
You played the turf?
We had to pay him. It wasn't a choice. And the thing about it was, like, if House was taken care of, all the guests would never have a problem. And House is actually, I mean, I have tons of photos of House. I actually have a rap video with House on YouTube.
We've heard it. I've heard it. Yeah.
So, that's true. You know, me and House became friends.
He was probably less corrupt than the actual city officials you'd have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, he's very straightforward. It's like, listen, I want this and you want this. Let's make a deal. City's like, I don't really, you know, this and that. So it did good. You know, like the first couple months it was like booked out. We started, I mean, I was 22, so my goals were a bit different. My goals were like to get wasted every night with the guests.
Yeah.
So I got wasted every night with the guests for 3 or 4 years straight. I was just like every night. I mean, I'll talk very much about like specific financials. Like it was probably bringing in like $10,000 a month. And if you're 23, that's like a lot of money. Yeah. You're just like $10,000 in cash. I literally had like a fucking shoebox by my desk where I would like throw money like a drug dealer, like House. When we go out at nights, I would pay for everybody's drinks at the hospital. He's like, oh, I got 10 there. Yeah, whatever. So I would pull a glob of cash. We'd go to the bar. I'd buy everybody drinks. We'd have fun. And it sounds fun. As you guys probably know, for a day or two, it's fun. Maybe for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
A year and a half in, I'm like, dude, what are you doing? This is embarrassing.
Burn
you know?
Yourself out quick.
And like, while it was like entertaining, it wasn't terribly intellectually stimulating because we were booked not because we were a great hostel or anything, just because like we were cheap and it's New York, you know? So we were always booked 100% every single night. I started doing some different odd jobs and stuff like that, but I still loved hostels. And so eventually I was like, listen, this is not sustainable.
Yeah.
I'm not, this 10 years from now, this will not exist. We need to like do something else. Like the city started cracking down. Like I didn't want to live in the ghetto anymore. It was like, I was ready to move.
House went to jail.
House went to this island. I had no more protection. It was terrifying.
There's no way for guests to let themselves in. So they wake up at like 4 a.m. Open the front door every single night.
So
like,
I mean, like, you want to talk the practicalities of it. Like when you make it happen, you make it happen. So like, it was because of the area, like, I wouldn't get my keys because I didn't want to get the keys getting out. And, like, I didn't want to get my coats because I couldn't go because it was, like, a brownstone. There's a downstairs. So we had a doorbell. So anytime the doorbell got rang, I had to let somebody in.
Oh, fuck.
And so, like, 3 o'clock in the morning, they rang the doorbell. I actually still hear the doorbell, like, in my nightmares. 6 years later, like, ding dong. And, like, fuck. And I'm yelling, like, no one's home. And so it was interesting. Like, the reviews as you came in. As you can imagine with this type of setup, we were a bit polarizing.
Yes.
Many people loved us. Some of us were... There was reviews that were like, I came at noon and the owner was blackout drunk.
Okay.
Listen, if you aren't prepared to be blackout drunk at noon, maybe you shouldn't stay at our hostel. So it was self-selecting after a while. So long story short, I knew it wasn't sustainable, so I moved to Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. Austin's like been a booming city for a long time.
Yeah, you moved at the right time.
Yeah, it's exciting. And the east side of Austin particularly is like, the happening spot of Austin right now. And at the time, there was two other hostels in Austin. There was 0 hostels on the east side of Austin. So there's an opportunity. You kind of like saw an opportunity. I remember like, when I go to a city and you want to get a good feel of it, nothing's better than just like walking the streets, you know? So I spent a couple weeks just like walking every street of East Austin, just getting a feel for it, stopping in the bar, stopping in the restaurant, stopping in the cafes. And finally,
CDs come through.
Yeah,
travelers are passing around.
CDs coming through. See what people are talking about. See kind of where the energy is.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting at a bar called Weather Up in Austin, and I looked across the street, and there's this like beautiful Victorian mansion, and like wraparound porches, and I was like, "That's the building," you know. And it wasn't for sale, and so I was like, "All right." And so I left, and I walked around, and then a week later, there's a sign in the yard, like a literal, like a metaphorically and like literal sign that like this is the time. So I called him. But when you're starting a hostel, you don't have a lot of money, so we had to rent it, as most people do when they kind of start hostels. Mm-hmm. Commercial lease, which are very like intense.
Terrifying.
Yeah, triple
and or could fuck you over.
A triple net, you know, like you're paying all expenses. Like if you do not pay, we will like break your kneecap.
Breach of lease.
Yeah.
Everything.
And I had no money, so like I laid it all on the table. Like, everything I made in New York, had to put it out there. And then I think the biggest part that I learned there is in New York, we didn't get any apartments. In Austin, that's not going to fly. You know, I wanted to create something that could stand the test of time and was going to be there in 10 years.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to do it legit. So I went to the city. And I think for most hostel owners, this is how it goes. You're like, you go to the city, you finally get a meeting with like the development department, right? And you're like, I want to open a hostel. They're like, what's a hostel? And you're like, well, it's like, fuck. Like, I blow my cover. I'm not getting permits after all.
Should have said bed and breakfast.
So you learn that. So finally I was like, well, it's like a hotel, but multiple beds in a room. And they're like, I don't understand. And then finally I was like, listen, it's like, I'm going to put bunk beds in a room and I rent them to people overnight. And they're like, they look through the code book, and because hostels aren't established in America, they're not in the code book. And they're like, they don't know where to put you.
Yes.
You know? And so you get in this limbo of like, the problem with cities is nobody wants to be wrong. That's the biggest thing about cities. Yeah. They don't want to take a stance. So like, they'll kick you to another floor. Like, oh, go talk to Jane on floor 7.
So I'm not signing.
Yeah, exactly. They don't want to be the wrong. They don't want to be the one if something goes wrong that they can get blamed for and get fired. So they're like, for literally a month, I would go to the city of Austin every single day, and I would ping pong between floors. As I go see like Jane on floor 7, I would go up there. She's like, I don't know, go see this person down there. And so finally, yeah, you guys are right. I was like, it's a bed and breakfast. Yeah. And they were like, oh, bed and breakfast. Oh,
that's such a wholesome idea.
And I was like, bed and breakfast. But then,
God bless you, son.
Another thing that I think is really important if you're thinking about opening a hostel is it was historically preserved. As you guys
know that game. Yeah.
It's like dun,
extra
dun,
difficult.
Dun. Yeah. It sounds great, but it's actually a nightmare.
Do you have to piss? Ask permission.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so then they were like, okay, it's a historic building. You need an elevator.
Oh, God.
And I was like, it's a short building. I can't get on an elevator. We have like 4 rooms. What are you talking about? And they're like, okay. But then this was the biggest debate. So like, to give you an understanding of like how the city doesn't communicate within departments, you have to be ADA compliant, which I understand. You're like 1 inch of rise, 1 foot of run. I get it. I need to have like a 20-foot ramp. Yeah. So they're like, you need architecture drawings for the ramp. And I was like, fine. Architecture drawings for the ramp. Concrete ramp. It's going to be beautiful.
Yeah.
Poured, you know, the railings.
Yeah.
Best
stamp. It's stamped. No, approved. I was like, awesome. I was like, contractor, come out. Pour a $4,000 ramp. Why not? And then the day it was going to come, the preservation officer for the city of Boston called me. He's like, you can't put in that ramp. And I was like, what are you talking about? The ramp's already approved. And he's like, no, that would alter the exterior of the building. It's a historic building.
No.
You can't put in a permanent ramp. I was like, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
And he goes, you need to put in a removable ramp. And I was like, the fuck is a removable ramp? And
he's
like, yeah, I was like, what are you going to put? And so he's like, you need to get like a custom cut aluminum ramp. And I was like, So I had to find a company to build a custom cut aluminum bridge. And this is all before you can ever take a guest, you know? This is before you know if the concept will even work. And so you have a budget in mind. You don't have a lot of money because, like, you know, you're trying to make things work. You're bootstrapping. And then you get hit with, like, a $7,000 ramp, and you're like, man.
Oh, it hurts.
Maybe I shouldn't have asked permission. You know? And then, but long story short, eventually we got the permits. The hostel did really good. Austin, as a byproduct, boomed as well. You know, it's big for the
hostels came after you.
Yeah. There's now 4, soon to be 5 additional hostels in Austin.
You were the second one, correct?
We were the third.
Okay.
Right. The first on the east side of Austin.
Okay.
But now there's 3 hostels on the east side of Austin. East side of Austin is like the Williamsburg of New York, if that makes
okay.
sense. It's kind of like the cool hipster, like artistic, trendy area. And it did good. You know, we had great ratings. Everything seemed fantastic. And then I think like as there's a transition, right? At first, you're an owner-operator, you know? So you own the building. You're the maintenance guy. You're the check-in guy. You're the repairman. You don't have enough money to, like, fix the water heater, so you Google how to fix water heater.
You know?
And then you spend, like, 4 hours. You spend 4 hours, like, using a dollar bill to, like, fucking, like, do the flame sensor. You know? It's actually what I had to do. And then you're like, you know, you're like, oh, the flame sensor works. But then eventually you get to the point where, like, the hostel's making an income where you can hire your first staff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such an important part.
Yes.
And, you know, it's easy to be lazy there, which I very much was. There was a hostel guest that was like a great guest. You know, that's how it all starts. You have a great guest. He seemed great. He was young. It was going to be his first job. And he was great as the first person as long as I was managing him. So you move into a managerial role. You're not doing all the tasks, but you're doing a lot of them. But then that goes good for a little. And then eventually you want to be like the owner of the business is not operating it. So you want to be hire a manager to manage everybody else and be able to step away for a couple of weeks. Because there was a period of time where, like, I didn't leave the hostel, like the building,
for six months.
Yeah. I didn't leave the building. I slept there. Yeah, you do. Yeah. You sleep there. And then you get terrified if you leave, something's going to go wrong. And, you're like, and it happens. It does go wrong. You leave, and you're like, God damn, I'm never leaving again. So you just, like, you sit in the hostel. Like, you become, this is not a scary office. It's, I love owning a hostel. But, like, you become a prisoner of your own making.
Yes.
You're like, you create this beautiful prison, right? Yeah. And you're just like, you're like
Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, you're able to build your own prison. But
bitches come in, party comes in.
Well, I have a rule about not, you know, this is a fraternizing. But anyways, you guys maybe have different rules. I don't know about that.
Yeah, all rules.
Anyways, so you're there and you're trying to find eventually, like, you know, step and find somebody that can manage it while you're not there every day. And I think that, like, it's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy person to find. And so I jumped on. I took, like, a month off. You know, I was like, you know what? I deserve a month off. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I stepped away for a month.
So how long later?
Probably, like, 8 or 9 months in. Okay. I was there, like, literally every single day. And then I was like, I'm going to take a month. I need to just, like, if this can't run on its own, then it's not a real business. That was my mentality.
That's a good way to look at it.
And I think this is an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah.
It couldn't run on its own yet. wasn't ready yet. So I jumped back in there. And, you know, I think I read this quote in a book, and Bobby and I talked about this before, but it's like, you know, people don't run businesses. Systems run businesses, and people run systems.
That's great.
And, like, I didn't have the systems in place to walk away for that amount of time. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, if you are thinking about opening a hostel, like, it's amazing to envision the, like, grand opening party, inviting your friends, popping champagne, and, like, the ego of, like, owning a business.
Yes, yes.
But the reality of it is, like, it sucks for a long time.
It
it'll suck for even longer if you don't spend the time to put the systems in place ahead of time. What's and I think it? That, like, listening to this podcast and other ways, you can learn from hostels that already exist, mm-hmm. obviously. And, like, I wish I would have done that earlier.
And creating those systems, I've found, or in our case, is, you know, doing it yourself and taking a lot of notes. You know, work every position, take a lot of notes on how you would ultimately do it. Because that's the most important thing, is that how you, the owner, manages or runs your operation. And then you're trying to get teams and to help you do it, and with your
own flair at it.
Yeah, with your own flair, because each hostel is so different, and you have to maintain that flair. But
yeah, exactly. It's just kind of like thinking about what you want to be, and finding people that can, like, and creating the systems that adapt into that vision. And everyone's gonna be a little bit different, but there are, like, I think base operational stuff that, like, you know, like cleaning schedules, you know, stuff that, like, everybody could take away from, and then you, like, kind of adapt. And then I think that, like, I think that evolution from, like, owner-operator to, like, manager-owner to, like, step-away-owner is important, because you do learn all those roles along the way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that, like, shortcutting it is a good way to do it.
No.
Or possible.
That's the foundation.
Yeah, exactly. So you need to learn all those roles on your way up, and I think it's a very important part of it.
And develop the managers underneath you.
Yeah.
That's so important, you know. Train them to be great.
And bring them, because, like, because as much as you love hostels, you're going to want a day not at the hostel, right?
It's healthy.
Healthy. Otherwise, you go a little bit crazy. And so, you know, I didn't do that. I wasn't very good at that, admittedly. I didn't create the system. So I would, like, white knuckle it. You know, I was like, fuck it. I'm going to go back. I'll work 7 days in a row. Yeah. I'll get a reviews back up to where they need to be, you know? And then so you're just like, you're like, what do you need today? You know, so you're kind of like, but it's, again, going back to the sustainability thing. It's not sustainable long term. So it took a while, but we kind of eventually found those systems. We found a manager. The hostel is called HK Austin in Austin.
Nice.
Our manager Josh has been there for 2 years. He's a badass.
Oh, yeah.
And Josh was originally a guest. So you do find great people that can come from guest to become, like, in a senior management role. Mm-hmm. And now at this point, Josh manages 4 to 5 volunteers that we get from World Packers. And he can kind of delegate to them. But again, it doesn't happen overnight. And if I think a way I could have cut down that learning curve was by learning from other hostels. Mm. You always think, like, I can figure it out. I'm smart. I'm going to do it my own way.
Yeah.
Or if you're a different personality, like I am, like, you just want to white knuckle everything. And you want to do it yourself. And, like, that day you have to, like, release control.
Yeah.
Is, like, it's a bit terrifying. But, like, again, like,
it's a baby.
I don't think it's a sustainable business if it can't run without you there as the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And so the day will come that you need to like do that, you know. It's like and so preparing for that in advance has been an important part.
Now, that is so true, and it's allowed you to come out here and do projects like this. And before we dive into that, I want to hear from you, Aaron, and how you got hooked up with this fucking desperado. We're rolling out of New York into Austin after House went to jail. And so how do you find yourself? Are you from Florida as well?
I'm from Florida. I did not know Brent in Florida.
Okay, I've never sat at a table drinking whiskey with this many Confederates, but okay.
It gets weird every time. It gets weird every time. I was in school at Tulane in New Orleans.
Oh, good school.
I was starting to put on all of the concerts in New Orleans. I booked Snoop Dogg at one point.
Snoop.
Saw Snoop's tour manager and I said, "You're a boss. How do I do what you do?" All
right.
She says, "Listen, you got to go into management. They'll figure it out. They'll start pointing you in the right direction."
Mm-hmm.
I went to school in London. I met an artist that I loved. I said, "What do I got to do to start working with you? I have costumes from New Orleans. I'll dance for you. I'll promote for you. Whatever you want." I didn't dance. I didn't care. I just wanted to be on the road. So I went on the... So he's like, "You know what? Come." We went to Moscow. Went for Uffy.
What?
Super fun all over the place. I came back to New Orleans after kind of all that. And kind of kept putting on concerts and things like that. And then moved to New York. Started working for an old big music exec.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in New York, I got connected through an old best buddy, and he's like, "You gotta meet Brent. He's always scheming. You're always scheming. I don't really get what you guys do every day, but you should probably know each other."
Okay.
I'm like, "Brent, listen, I have this soft spot for artists. They don't understand the world, but they understand creative in their own way, and they see something that we don't."
Mm-hmm.
And I guess like my whole job is to take these people and amplify that to the world.
Right.
And Brent's like, "Oh, cool. I love, you know, scheming ways to get the word out there on like very strange artists and things like that."
To actually interject and bring this full circle, the guy he's talking about that connected us is a guy named Matt Aber, and Bobby is the guy.
Is that Nomadic Matt?
Different guy, but
okay.
Matt Aber actually moved to Valdosta, Georgia because of Bobby to play golf with him.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So there's a little small world thing.
And so now what we didn't mention is that you also have a very successful career in PR and advertising.
Correct.
I often call you the modern Don Draper.
Oof.
Yes, big shoes to fill.
Oh, yeah, it's been big shoes.
Yeah, but with lots
I'm not
of
that handsome. Let's be real.
That's why we're doing a podcast. Yeah. But you've had a lot of books that you've helped become bestsellers.
Right, right. And so that's actually why Aaron and I originally connected.
Okay.
Because like Aaron was interested in like, Aaron always has an ear to like interesting marketing. Also, his artist, Young and Sick, we connected on like marketing, and so I guess that's leads back in.
Yeah, like so I essentially started signing like artists, illustrators, kind of all sorts of visual, like just artists in general.
Yes.
Knowing nothing, I had an artist get kicked out of the country for overstaying visas, signing Europeans. I was attracted to all that, but none of it really ever made sense. And it was just like, "Hey, everyone should know about this artist. How do we keep getting the word out?" And that's where in came Brent.
Okay.
And I kind of started coming in, and Brent was selling books the whole time.
Nice.
I'm like, "Brent, listen, if you can market a book, you can market these artists."
All right.
You know, none of it really makes sense, but these people are beautiful. And Brent's like, "I'm in. Let's do this. Let's do that." And suddenly we started getting press. And everything started to connect little by little by little. I was one of Brent's many patrons on his many Drunk by Noon experiences at his hostel.
Yeah. Aaron went to the hostel once or twice.
Twice. You know, we panic carrying our laptops to his hostel. Make sure it was only during the
light
day.
Jog,
But we did it. And so we slowly started kind of building, you know, some of my stuff together, and we always were on the phone nonstop, and I was always kind of picking, I mean, Brent's brain's brilliant.
Yeah.
Beautiful
mind.
But it's a completely different kind of business, I guess.
Mm.
And, you know, since then, like, I've started signing a bunch of record deals. I work with this artist, Young and Sick, this artist, Kaisen. We've been doing, you know, art for a lot of, you know, big pop artists and music festivals and kind of things like that.
I've seen a festival up here forming in my mind.
Yeah.
You know?
It's 100% coming.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It's nice because as I've started to learn the music business as a whole, there's these huge trends in culture, and I always like to like say that the two biggest things on this planet are music and sex, but people have sex and music.
Forever.
Right? And it's like
yes.
that is it. And
that Latin lover over there, he's going to say, yeah.
But it's exciting, right? Because like the whole entire music industry has shifted to LA. And in LA, they have these things called writing camps where essentially pop artists are looking for songs all the time. So you have some of the biggest songwriters and producers. They get together for a week. They try to make song, 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 song. They play them at the end of the writing camp. Everyone listens. And then that's business people go off and they try to sell songs.
Oh.
And that's kind of how the...
It's like an incubator of songwriting.
Right. It's called music publishing. So there's like two pieces of intellectual property in music. There's the master, what you hear on the radio.
Uh-huh.
And there's the songwriting, the written word and the piece. So like something, I look at this place and I want to see songwriting camps out here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's always just super exciting. And the other kind of big trend in music right now are these like micro festivals. America's had like this... Walmartization of music festivals, a little something for everybody, and now like all across Scandinavia there's these trends where it's like, let's build a festival for 500 to 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to pay for these A-list artists, let's only pay for B, C, or just C and D-list artists. But the truth is let's just focus hyper on one small niche.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, that niche, no one cares to see the A-list, or they only want to see the up-and-comers,
right.
And they'd rather do it in a smaller environment. So
that's what it is. Music Festival.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like that.
Yeah, but like I think that like part of music management, what's so interesting is that there's so many businesses to it, right? There's merch, there's live touring, there's the records, there's the contract negotiations, it's dealing with PR, so many revenue streams. And I guess it's very hard because you have to learn all these
mm-hmm.
micro businesses. And I think that's where Brent has been such a huge help. He's always kind of gone all in. If I believe in something, Brent believes in something,
yeah.
Anytime I can help him, it's...
And you wear a lot of different hats, and you're wearing
literally,
a good one right now.
But I think to circle this back to Sarah Gorda, Aaron is actually the reason that we're sitting here today in many ways, because Aaron knew that another partner of ours named John Beer and I were looking at like interesting locations that were within 4 hours of like a major city to potentially open like a destination type of place that had an experience that was only available there. And Aaron knew that, and Aaron saw the link to Sarah Gorda one for sale, and he texted to us at like 2 a.m. It was kind of like a... You guys need to check this out.
I called Brent like 3 times.
Yeah.
At like 11 p.m. my time, it was like 1 or 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta wake up. I'm sorry. This is nuts.
Because John and I had actually put in an offer at a hotel in the Catskills.
Outside
New York. Like, we were like very far along in a negotiation there. And then this came, and like, I think that the thing that people, I mean, our thesis for like a place like this is that like people are looking for an experience that's only available there, right?
Yeah.
You can stay in a Marriott in 70 countries. It feels the same everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can go next
cookie
door. And you can go to the Starbucks. So like the globalization has created this kind of like, cookie cutter type experience.
Yeah.
And so people are looking for experiences that are only available there.
Absolutely.
And you can do that in a variety of ways. It can be because of the like, you know, experience that you give them, the hospitality element of it, but it could also be like the history of the place. And so like when we heard of the history of this place, we were just like, wow. And like my mind always goes to marketing, and John, our partner, is also a bachelor's background.
Treasure trove of marketing.
And we saw it, and Aaron texted it to us at like he said 2 a.m. And then it was kind of like joke-ish, but 9 a.m. the next morning I called the real estate broker. I was like, listen, we need this property, you know? And he's like, I'm sure you do, but since this has gone live, we've already had 200 offers.
Wow.
And we're like, okay, he's like, so what you need to do is you need to write out a plan what you're going to do with it, and you need to send me proof of funds.
That's
what
it's about.
Who's got that?
When I call Brent, there's one piece of press on boingboing.net.
Yeah.
By the next morning, there was, every piece of press across the globe.
Wow.
Because whoever sold it, it was smart.
Yeah.
Entire ghost town was on sale for $100 million. In the grand scheme of life.
That's the rare opportunity.
Yeah. It's a rare opportunity.
The real estate broker crushed it. Basically, like, he knew that, like, the headline of... He knew it was going to sell for over $1 million, but he knew by pricing it under $1 million, the press would pick up on that you could buy a town for under $1 million. And so he was really smart in his own right. So it went for sale, and we knew it was going to go for more than $1 million. We called him. We put in an offer. I wrote up this thing about, like, how much we loved history and how we wanted to preserve the town but introduce amenities to make it more comfortable for more people to stay here. And how, like, we were history buffs and we read every single book about the property.
It had to be an emotional sell.
There
was no way we could win financially.
To overcome.
There was no way we could win.
Right.
There's no way.
Corners.
I mean,
or like San Francisco. Someone comes in with a $5 million bid, and then that's the end of that. You know?
So we supported that to them. The emotional sell only goes so far, though, right? So they got offers that were over $2 million for the property. And we came in at 1.4, to be fully transparent with you.
Yep.
And our thing was like, listen, we're not going to turn this... The other offers were like to turn into like a weed farm, you know? Another one was turned into like a pine thing. Somebody from Florida wanted to tear it all down and build like a subdivision.
Oh, God.
Which is wrong in so many ways because like they don't understand the infrastructure problems here. But that's a whole other conversation. So basically, it turns out that the previous owners of the place wanted to do something very similar to what we wanted to do. They wanted to preserve it, but introduce amenities to make it comfortable for more people.
Oh, okay.
And so, like, it struck that right chord with them.
It lined
up. And we were also the only people. 2 days after we put in an offer, I flew from Austin. We got in Aaron's car. We drove out from LA that day, and we, like, met with them, you know?
Nice.
Everybody else, nobody else came out here.
Boom, boom.
And we
yeah.
came out here. We
aggressive
met,
maneuvers.
We met with the owner. We met with the real estate owner. We met with Robert. We met with some other people. And we walked around the property, and we kind of, like, pitched them on the vision that we had. They pitched us on kind of what they wanted from it. And at the end of the day, like, the only word for it was, like, it felt right, you know? We felt
great.
Good with them. They felt good with us.
The ghost didn't act up.
Yeah, no ghost sightings. And so it was cool, you know, like then, and then kind of the progression of a property like this is like, then you close and it's exciting. And then like for John and I, then we just went into like press overdrive. Like we knew the story was there. And so like, I think if you can find a property with a history and like with a story to it, and you can like tell that story correctly to the press,
mm-hmm.
then you're at a leg up on like, let's just say like the generic Marriott that we said before,
yes.
because again, people are looking for the experience that's only available there.
Yeah.
And so like John and I, that's what we do for a living. So we kind of like went into press drive. So like
Mad
our kind of like tier, our plan for us was like close, press, raise more money, start doing stuff.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
like
yeah.
we closed, then it's the fun part. Beginning press is fun. It's an ego boost, right? Everybody
sure.
feels good when like somebody's interviewed. Like I feel
yeah.
great right now.
He's been hard for 3 years.
That's why we're doing a podcast. And so you close, you get a lot of press, you feel great. You feel like you're doing something when you get press, but at the end of the day, it's like, it's not really doing anything, you know?
Yeah.
And so we leverage that press to raise more money. And now, right now, as we sit here, we're in the phase where like it's time to start doing stuff.
Sure.
So we have two contracting teams up here. They're starting to renovate the first buildings that we do. But a project like this, like, it's 380 acres. There's 22 buildings here. All in a state of arrested decay. And so it's overwhelming, particularly for me, like going from a hostel, the HK Austin has 22 beds right now. So to go from 22 beds to 22 buildings,
wow.
you're like, oh, fuck.
When a ramp was your biggest
obstacle.
Now we have water.
Now we have water. We have water. We have a death trap road. You know, so we have like issues at hand.
Fucking ghosts.
Yeah, we have fucking ghosts. man, and so like right now it's kind of like the only way that we can manage something like that is like focusing building by building. So our plan right now is just to kind of renovate the first building, bring it
yeah.
up to the comfort level that we want the rest of the buildings to be at.
All
right. So that way that people can kind of like get an understanding of the finish out that we want for the entire property. So when we bring people up, it's not like right now it's glorified camping. You know, you're like,
yeah.
there's no running water. You're peeing in an outhouse, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But once we get the first building there, I think that we'll be able to like proof of concept a little bit more for people.
Yeah.
And then renovate out from there.
All right, well, let me take a quick break for our sponsorship plug and to leave the listeners dangling a little bit more about what the experience is going to be here up in this awesome ghost town, 3 hours east of LA. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
James, question for you. How can you be on the road recording this podcast away from your 6 properties?
Easy. I rely on CloudBeds, the all-in-one property management suite. To help grow my reservations and keep my guests happy. With CloudBeds software, I have one place where I can see everything going on with my business, from daily check-ins to comprehensive reporting.
Tell me more.
My staff loves it too, because it's incredibly easy to use and automates a lot of their daily tasks. This means we all get to focus on the most important thing, our guests.
Cool. How do I get started?
Our friends at CloudBeds are offering a $50 credit to Hostel Road Trip podcast listeners. Just visit cloudbeds.com/roadtrip. Again, go to cloudbeds.com/ROADTRIP and see why tens of thousands of properties trust CloudBeds to power over 700,000 beds worldwide.